Hi, this is Craig Ballantyne, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show. Hey, think you're a good communicator? You're going to be very surprised by what you learn on today's show. According to dark arts persuasiveness coach Cherie Alexander, most people aren't making the most of the words that they use. They're losing out on the power of positive, profitable influence. Now, Cherie knows all about this. You see, she spent years interviewing masters of influence, including world-class con artists, interrogators, CIA field agents, and law enforcement officers. She's learned these dark arts of persuasion, and she's made a career out of teaching people how to use the tools of influence for positive success. Now, on today's episode of the podcast, I actually turned the mic over to ETR editor Jeff Steen. So it's really cool. This is Jeff's first show, and he's going to talk to Cherie about some of her amazing experiences, and she's going to tell plenty of edgier seat stories and how she managed to land major business and political clients using her unique skills. So on this show, she really gets into the nitty-gritty, and there's a no-holds-barred episode inside. So be prepared for some real harsh truths about what you and I are doing wrong in our communication. Now, the good news is that Cherie offers plenty of tactical and strategic advice on how to collect the right info from peers and colleagues and clients via very well-prepared, organic conversation and the best ways to land a big sale. And it's here's a little hint. It's not the script you've heard a million times. But before we get to it, though, I want to remind you that Early to Rise Radio is brought to you by the Perfect Day Formula. Grab your free copy of this blueprint to success and live the life of your dreams and get it at freeperfectdaybook.com. It's a really great follow-up to Cherie's interview, and it gives you even more tools to leverage your influential communication, fine-tune routines, and expert advice to help you create your perfect days. Now let's get to that interview with ETR editor Jeff Steen and dark arts persuasiveness coach, Cherie Alexander.
Cherie, thank you so much for taking the time today to talk. We're going to chat a little bit about some of what you're doing right now, some of your history, introduce folks to you if they don't already know you, and give people a sense of the communications world in which you live and the way you help people. A lot of interesting questions around how you paint your own profession and describe yourself. So I'm just going to dive right in with some questions and we can kind of take it from there.
Okay.
Based on some of the content that's on your website, you're described as sort of a persuasiveness coach who's bringing the dark arts of influence into the light, which is very compelling. But for someone who's not familiar, can you unpack that a little bit?
Sure. So in my career, I have always had a distinct passion around the power of words, meaning that our words can change somebody's mind, can change somebody's heart, can change a community, can change a country, can change a culture. And yet, because we use words every single day, we take that power for granted. And I wanted to seek out who are the superheroes of words? Who are the ones who have been able to harness that power and use it at its highest level? So I sought out those masters of wordsmithing, and I sought out the masters who use it for good, and I sought out the masters who use it for not so good. And so through my research, I was able to fortunately connect with individuals who include CIA field operatives. So you're talking about literally life and death situations of trying to get somebody to share state secrets with a perceived, you know, foreign enemy. I also learned from con artists who obviously manipulated people into making decisions. Also hostage negotiators who Like once again, it's a high pressure life and death situation, but also those are the same people that are called to help somebody who's potentially going to commit suicide. And once again, the thing that changes a situation, if this is going to play out in a good way or a bad way, is how somebody says and what they say to that person and the timing in which they say it. So what I do is I translate everything that I've learned from those people, and I take it from the major leagues that they're playing in, and just I bring it down to the minors and help people be better leaders and help people sell more in their business and be able to communicate their message in an authentic way that is still influential.
The way you describe it makes me think that when you first started that journey, that exploration, that it was personally motivated. Is that fair to say, first of all? And then second of all, at what point did you decide that, oh, this was a niche that could become sort of a professional world for me?
It's somewhere in the middle. I actually discovered that I had a fraction of this talent. I started out in my past life, is what I call it. I was an actress, and was I was going to be an actress and be on stages on Broadway. Once I decided that wasn't the right path for me, I got my one and only quote unquote real job, and I did PR work for a national nonprofit. And it was in that context of people who are just business type people, who didn't have this skill set that I had learned from my stage training. And the quintessential moment was I was able to land the largest account that they had seen in over 5 years. And I did it within the first 6 weeks of being on the job.
Wow.
So I made a name for myself, and I was just surprised that people were so surprised, because I was like, oh, you mean you can't do this too? And that was kind of the catalyst moment of, oh, not everybody has been trained. I mean, I got my training from the world of art, but it clearly translated into the world of business, and I took that for granted. So that's, yes, it was personally spurred because I have a fascination around this world, but also it was because I got shown a spotlight of, oh, maybe there's something to this as well, kind of a thing.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, you know, you call that example, which is a great showcase of sort of how you came to that understanding. Can you talk a little bit about what specifically was lacking in other people's communication and their use of words in that scenario that made it more difficult for them versus yourself, who easily landed that account in 6 weeks?
Sure. I mean, I don't want to say easily as if it was effortless. I mean, I still put in work and I did my research. I did my research on my client and all that good stuff. I would say if I had to put a button on what was lacking, quote unquote, from others, it was the lack of storytelling in the presentation, the lack of, you know, you can walk in and have an interesting statistic, but unless you can paint a picture of what that statistic looks like in somebody's life, or paint a picture of what that statistic really means, unless they can envision a face or see a movie with what you are describing, then there is no emotional connection to it. And so ultimately that's one of the biggest skill sets, is how can you create a movie in somebody's mind, both, and if we translate this to sales, how can you create the movie of what it's like if they don't work with you, if they don't sign up with you, but still do it in a compassionate way? Again, you don't want to go into the dark arts of manipulating somebody and making them feel horrible about themselves, making yourself out to be the messiah that they've been looking for. No, don't do that. paint a picture of what it would look like without making a decision. And then what is that movie? Paint that picture of what it does look like to work with you and what those results are, could look like, because very often people don't have as clear of a vision for themselves as you have for them. And so you have to be able to paint that picture.
The way you've described that seems to me to be sort of a very mature understanding of the role of storytelling and how it's applicable. And I trust that part of that is due to the many years of experience doing what you do and all of those interviews you conducted and the knowledge that you've collected. I'm wondering, though, along the way, what struggles with words and communications have you had? You mentioned before that you sort of have a fraction of the talent that is part of this world. So what do you still struggle with in that realm?
So I'm probably a bit of an odd duck in this answer. Because obviously, I mean, I've been doing this for over a decade now, so I've improved my skill set since then. And I can identify my strengths. My weakness in my everyday life, when I'm not on, when I'm not in superstar Cherie mode, where I'm selling something, or if I'm speaking at a conference of some sort, my weird everyday life issue is I lean towards listening a heck of a lot more than I do talking. So I often walk away from gatherings or house parties with me knowing every detail of somebody's life. I mean, people, like, if there is a theme song or like motto of what people say to me regularly, it's, I've never told anybody this. Like, the number of times I hear that, honestly, it's because I genuinely am curious about people, and because of what I've learned from my mentors and, you know, my Yodas and Mr. Miyagis, I've developed that skill set even more. But I'll walk away from a gathering knowing so much about everybody around me, and then them not knowing a darn thing about me. So I feel like that is something that I do need to work on, in that I can connect with people by them feeling that they can connect with me. In my everyday life, I don't connect with them by sharing about me as much as I feel like I should. Does that make any sense?
No, it does. Absolutely. I think in my experience, some of that is just sort of an innate personality or personal quality that you likely have that sort of compels people to share details. You know, you make them feel at ease and comfortable. And again, that might tie into some of the training that you've received and, you know, the wisdom that you've gotten over the years. But
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I already had that natural tendency, and then you stack on all the techniques I have with it. Then, yeah, there's two sides to every coin, and that's one of the sides of that coin.
Sure. I'm interested to dive into, you explained it a little bit already, but sort of the dark arts is very compelling. And some of the techniques that are used in negative ways can have, can be of advantage and for good cause, used to good cause. And yet some of those things are on the fence sometimes, and people worry about ethical issues. So I guess this question is a two-parter. How many of those do you actually advocate people using? And then how do you deal with the ethical issues and sort of that line between influence and manipulation?
I've never been asked this one before.
It's good.
No, I've been asked it every single time I talk to somebody.
I'm just kidding.
I dare to argue you saying that some of the techniques that are used for negative purposes can be positive. I argue that every single technique can be used for negative and positive purposes. With the exception of, now we have to be careful with our language here. So there's influence and persuasion, which I use interchangeably, that are, in my personal opinion, morally neutral. You can be negatively influential and you can be positively influential. Same with persuasive. Manipulation inherently means that your actions could lead to a negative outcome for the other person. Now, in that realm, we're just talking about words mostly. Then we have the super dark side that does not have a positive twist, which is coercion. And coercion means that you are putting the other person either under physical or psychological threat. So obviously torture is a level of coercion, or saying that your family could get harmed if you don't take this action is coercion. So that's definitely the depths of the dark arts, which we do not touch. So with that, if we bring it just simply to the realm of words, I argue that every technique that you perceive to be negative can be used positively. So, I mean, a hammer is the ultimate example here. A hammer can build a house that puts a roof over somebody's head, and a hammer can also bash somebody's head in.
Right.
Now, tell me, is the hammer morally good or morally evil? It's not. There's nothing wrong with the hammer. It's how the hammer is used.
Right.
So then we go into your second part of the question, which is, what are the moral lines? So to the second part of your question about the moral question of, you know, is the hammer morally good or morally bad? It's not. So I always speak on how these tools can be used for positive purposes, because there unfortunately is an instant negative association to the word influence. Because when people think of influence, they only think of the times when somebody attempted and failed to be influential, which means they did it poorly, which means they felt like they were trying to be manipulated. Influence, when it works, influence at its best goes completely unnoticed. It's like a magic show. If you see how the trick is done, then that's a terrible magician. But when the trick happens and you have no clue how in the world she did it, well, now that's real, quote unquote, real magic.
Right.
That's how influence should be. We are influenced all the time. Techniques are happening all the time. It's just the only time you notice it is when it's done really poorly. So that's the connotation that I have to get up on my soapbox and try to change for people, is you choosing ignorance about influence is giving people who do not have the same moral compass as you more power. Because the people that have no moral compass are totally okay with screwing over individuals, are actively seeking this out. They are reading books. They are talking to fellow con artists. They are talking to other people that are breaking the law in one way or another. But because you're a quote unquote average person and you don't want to be associated with that type of behavior, you're only giving those individuals more rope, more leeway, because you're choosing ignorance. And I do not want people to be ignorant about influence.
Right. And that actually brings up an interesting question. You said that you spend a lot of your time making clear that distinction to people and the role of influence in their lives. How much of, going back to the idea of the hammer and the tool, how often do you see that tool being used unwittingly to negative ends? And how much effort do you spend making that known to people?
I don't think I see it very often where somebody's unwittingly using it negatively, meaning that they have the intention to be manipulative. What I often see is people trying to copy influential techniques without understanding the principles, and therefore it's sloppy, it's poorly done, and that's why they're email marketing isn't working. That's why their sales conversations aren't closing. That's why nobody's signing up for their lead magnet on their website. It's because more often than not, they're just copying what they're seeing other people doing, or, you know, following some course where some guy's like, oh, just follow my perfect script. And that script may work for that person with that target market at that time. But if you have no base understanding of the principles, the psychology of influence as to why that worked in that way, and then be able to craft it in your own authentic voice and be able to change with your target market, change as you grow, but still have that influential power behind everything that you do, then you're just always going to be on that hamster wheel spinning in circles, not understanding why it's not clicking.
Which actually that ties into a question I'm going to ask a little bit later, but I'm glad you mentioned that. We'll come back to it in a second. You've sort of been on the topic of words. We've discussed words a lot, but clearly a part of communication is also physical. So I'm wondering if you talk a little bit about how that figures into what you teach, and how that is a part of the world of influence generally for people, what people should be aware of as far as facial expressions and body language.
Yeah, so I'm certified in micro expressions and body language and all that good stuff. And that's where I started as well. I honestly thought that would be a bigger portion of this conversation about influential communication. But what I've discovered is, first of all, there's a whole lot of misinformation about body language. It is much more nuanced than, some article that you see on Forbes of the 10 body language signs of whatever.
Right.
So that's one aspect of it. And the other aspect is, in my time doing this, where I see the biggest knowledge gap is really in the how to guide a conversation successfully, how to have control of a conversation without somebody noticing. And if we get into the spy world, then basically what I'm talking about is elicitation techniques. And what elicitation is that when you are, there's three styles of conversation. There's interrogation, there's interview, and then there's elicitation. In an interrogation, if I'm interrogating you, then I have control. I have control over your surroundings. I have control of if you can come or go. And you know that I am seeking information from you, and you could potentially be hostile against giving that information to me. That's an interrogation. We're both very clear as to what's happening in interrogation. The second is an interview. And an interview is what you and I are doing right here. You clearly are trying to get information from me, and I am a willing participant in giving the information that you seek. Then there's elicitation. And specifically in the spy world, in the intelligence community, what elicitation is that I want some information from you, but I don't want you to be aware of the fact that, one, I'm seeking information, and two, the specific information that I'm seeking. I'm trying to be covert about those two things. I want you to feel like this is the most organic conversation you've ever been a part of. And so basically what that boils down to is people don't know how to have strategic conversations. And that's where I step in teaching people exactly how do you have that strategic conversation. Now, it could be very specific and goal-oriented, like a sales conversation. Where most people go wrong in sales is they start by thinking, oh, what should I say? How do I sell this? How do I present my value? And that's the worst place to start. Where you need to start in any aspect of influence is by asking yourself the question, what do I need to know? Analyze what information do you know about this person, their situation, their hopes, their dreams, their fears. And then second, identify those knowledge gaps. Say, I have no idea what they're afraid of. I have no idea what they're wanting to accomplish. And now you know where you want to guide that conversation. Ultimately, influence is a dance. Somebody's leading, somebody's following, and it interchanges around it during that conversation. So then it's all about how do I have that successful, organic, quote unquote, organic conversation with this person. So then I gather all the information I need. And then at the end of the conversation, I then piece those things together to pitch the value, sell, make the sale, close the deal, all of that good stuff. So wrapping this back around to the body language and visual aspect, really and truly, it's a big factor if your body language is a big hindrance. However, in my experience, that is rarely the case in comparison to the knowledge gap of having a successful strategic conversation with somebody.
So really the thrust of it is in the words and the preparation is what I'm hearing.
Yes. And the listening and
the
knowing
right.
and knowing what you need to listen for. There's actual, you know, anchors that you listen for and hot buttons that you go, okay, I got that. Now I'll move on to this next thing that I don't know yet.
Do you find that when people are properly prepared with words, they know the words to use, the language that would serve them best in that conversation, and they have prepared for that conversation, that the body language just tends to follow?
Yes. And also keep in mind, so when you start a conversation and you're of the mindset of what should I say, then hello performance anxiety.
Right, right.
And your body language radiates that, which translates to fear, desperation, all of these things that are highly unattractive. So that is what's going to be a layer that is off-putting to the person that you're trying to sell to.
Sure, sure.
Now, if you go the other direction, which is my prescribed method of don't worry about what you should say, ask yourself, what do I need to know? Well, congratulations, you don't have to be the dancing monkey. You are now putting the other person in the spotlight, and then they, in a sense, now need to do the performing. They are the ones that are, you know, that are your center of focus. You are not your own center of focus. They are your center of focus. And so all of that stress and weight on your shoulders of performing goes away, which guess what happens to your body language? You're centered, you're calm, you're in a receiving type of energy rather than performing or projecting type of energy. And it's such a much more relaxed place to be. And guess what? The shoulders go down, the head tilts to the side a little bit in a listening frame of mind. Your mouth is closed because you're listening and you're not, you know, out of breath and your mouth isn't dry. And so, I mean, body language, yes, there's a few things with I, in my over a decade of doing this, have had two individuals that I've worked with where we started with the body language because there was some issue that needed to be worked through specifically. But with everybody else, we start from the inside, that it's the energy that we're shifting, the frame of mind, the plan ahead of time, and then the body language follows suit.
Right. Right. And as long as you have that preparation in place, then the elicitation of information becomes that much easier, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested to know, you have served a lot of different people, a lot of different clients, people's different positions. We've talked about sales a lot because I think that that's an apt example, a good place for application of some of these practices. But can you talk a little bit about the kinds of people you serve in general? And then in your experience over the last decade or so, what kinds of people have been most successful? And do those people need to come to the table with some prerequisites for them to be successful?
That's an interesting question. No, I really don't think that there's a prerequisite. I haven't seen it. I've seen people who have, you know, built very, very successful businesses and just want to be simply more successful. And so clearly they have built-in habits and they change those habits. I mean, ultimately, it's the answer of any successful client in a coaching relationship is somebody that's open and willing and applies the work. The only I've had, of course, not naming any names, but I've had maybe two what I would call dud clients over the years. And the only reasons that they weren't successful was they just weren't they flat out didn't take the advice. They were just resistant to it. They kept falling into their own habits, doing it their way. They weren't proactive in it. And they just thought, oh, if I just hire somebody, then magically everything will. And it's like, no, this is coaching. You have to put in the work. But really and truly, what I offer my clients is almost shedding light on things they already inherently know. And then when they see the ripple effect of learning this information, meaning, yeah, I predominantly talk about sales and I talk about marketing, but this stuff applies to having a great relationship with your significant other. This stuff applies to being more successful as a parent. It applies to meeting people in the dating scene. I mean, it's communication is universal. So
right, yeah.
When they see so many levels of the application, really and truly, it becomes even more easy for them because it's a constant factor in their life. It's not just, you know, oh, I'm teaching you how to swim, and so the only times you're practicing the swim technique is when you're in the pool. You know, when it comes to teaching communication, you're in the pool all the time. So
right,
you
right.
see those opportunities more.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Is there, this might be a difficult one, in part because your clientele is so diverse, but is there one technique that you teach that has had more success, more widespread success than others? I'm just curious if there's one that really resonates with the clientele.
Oh, it depends on how you define success, bro.
That's true. That's fair.
Because for some it's a personal, for some it's a business, for some it's, you know, resolving a conflict of a relationship that's been a struggle for years. So ultimately, I wouldn't say that there's one technique. Yes, I teach specific techniques of like, okay, here's the framework of say this, say that type of a thing. But really and truly, my teachings are based off of models. So here is the framework. Here is why this framework works. Now you add your own words to make it fit your personality. So based off of so the frameworks themselves are the most eye-opening, whether it's, okay, if you're trying to build a marketing campaign and trying to sell to many, you can't have that sales conversation one-on-one to get the information. So how do I get that information when I'm making up this target market in my head? Great. Here's the framework. Okay. What's the framework for the sales conference? So there's not one technique. However, I have been called out by my clients on techniques, which is always fun. So, I'll share one with you. There's a technique called the bucket technique. And what the bucket technique is, so for example, in whenever I'm in conversations about speaking engagement and the discussion of fees comes up, one way to handle that conversation is to say, well, if you're trying to figure out, okay, what's the budget of this organization? You could say something along the lines of, well, what I've learned is that there's usually three types of companies that reach out to me seeking speaking engagements. The first one is that has a budget of next to nothing to like $1,000. And in which case I'm probably not a fit because my fee range is outside of that. The second type of group is the type of group that has a budget of about $3,000 to maybe $8,000. And then the third type is the type of group that has the budget of $10,000 and more. Which of those three categories do you guys best fit in? So that's a way to start the conversation of budget ranges without saying, well, how much money you got?
Right.
And then, so therefore your prospect self-selects which bucket they belong into. And I've had coaching clients after they've been through a course or been a one-on-one client. I know that I've had conversations where I would say, well, basically it boils down to that there's three outcomes here, or there's three methods or whatever. I can't think of the specific example at the moment, but I've had a client say, you just bucketed me. I'm like, well, I guess I did. I mean, these things come naturally because it's supposed to be natural conversation.
Right.
But so when it's always a joy when a client calls out a technique, when they either see it in my speeches, on my webinars, or just in normal conversations. That's always great. Just the teacher inside of me loves knowing that the student has learned and assimilated.
Right, of course. You brought up something, and again, this has been a thread throughout our conversation, but that sort of element of natural or organic conversation. One of the things that came to mind as I was doing research for the interview was the extent to which what you teach should ultimately become an unconscious reflex. And I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit. And if that is true, how you create that reflex? Is it by building associations, contextual associations, or is it practice-based? How do you deal with that? How do you approach it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, that is the hope, that it becomes kind of unconscious knowledge that just simply is there. It's like, you know, breathing, it's going to the gym, it's brushing your teeth, it's just something you do. And there's some part of your question. Say that one part again. Sorry.
In asking that if it should be moved from a conscious action to a reflex, which you responded to, and then how you get them there. Is it about repetition of certain exercises? Is it about association within a context? How do you go about ensuring that becomes
right?
Reflex.
I think, I mean, not to toot my own horn, but the frameworks that I teach are just so applicable that once you understand how they work and you just have them on a post-it note on your computer or something, there's just very few times when you don't see how it could be applied. There's very few conversations when your brain doesn't get the flag and the antenna goes up saying, oh, that's one of the influential hot buttons. So I hope, and I have somewhat prided myself on the fact that the frameworks are designed to make themselves prevalent and relevant in your world, that they can't be missed. So, and then of course you putting into practice is just simply the next step of, okay, now how do I tie this together? And then there was, so your question, this is where I was trying to think earlier, your question prompted this story that I love from one of the CIA field operatives that I interviewed. And I asked him, I said, man, based off of everything that you shared and all your accomplishments and everything that you've done around the world, and what he had described to me is his level of observation. So the influential process is three steps. People often think, oh, it's influence, so it starts with what do I say? But we've now learned the first question is, what do I need to know?
Right.
So, which means your first step in the process is observation, to observe. Your job is to just simply pay attention. The second step is to connect. So create that rapport, develop that feeling of relationship with the person. And then the final last step is influence. So observe, connect, influence. And he had shared with me his skill of observation and what to pay attention to and the levels at which he can pay attention. And so I said to him, man, your wife must love you because you can notice every little thing and you know the signs.
Right.
And he said, you would think, wouldn't you? So he said, in fact, that's one of our biggest fights. All right, Birdie's coughing. I'll stop for a second. All right. He said, in fact, that's one of our biggest fights is she will say to me, I know you know how to do this. You do not have the excuse of being a normal man in this situation. And so that was a huge lesson for me in that it is just, it's exactly like one of those other skills or skill sets that you simply need to keep up, that you need to keep in the front part of your awareness. So, you know, going to the gym regularly and working out, you can't just go once and expect that one time of a workout to last you 90 days. You got to keep going. You got to keep doing it. If you break out of the habit, getting back into it might take a little while, or it's just going to be more rusty. So that's, if anything, that's one thing that I try to make clear to my clients, and another reason why I try to make those frameworks so applicable in so many situations, so that you can keep that wheel greased, so that those gears keep turning, that it is as universal as it possibly can be, because you don't want to just, you know, sit back, relax, and expect magic. You got to make the magic happen.
Yeah. No, and that's definitely clear. Craig is big on accountability for a lot of different reasons and a lot of different cases. I'm just wondering, outside of the coaching relationship that you have with some of your clients, the best ways for them to be held accountable, if the frameworks that you present are valuable enough to them in the business context or personally, then it might be easy for them to implement. But surely there have been instances where people need to be held accountable and you can't hold their hand the entire time. So what do you offer them to keep them on track?
That's interesting. So because what I teach is so situation-based, it's not like, okay, I'm trying to think of an example here, like, you know, okay, stick to this workout routine, follow this specific routine. Right. There's not a lot of routine to it, because again, if we talk about the word organic, there's no routine conversation. If there is routine in every conversation, then that in and of itself is a problem.
Yeah.
Because you clearly aren't opening yourself up to opportunities or being observant to see the subtext of what somebody's saying and be able to go down certain rabbit holes with people to get to something new and interesting and undiscovered. So with that, there's just not that routine element. With that said, I don't have a perfect answer for you on the accountability itself, outside of coaching relationship or the course or the mastermind. Two parts to that, answer. One is, when I do talk to leadership teams, I do speak on ways that they can incorporate that routine. Meaning, if you are a manager, if you are a leader of some sort, you should be having one-on-one conversations with your team members weekly. Now, it can be 15 minutes blocked off the calendar each week. But if you keep that routine, then, you know, sometimes you may only need 3 minutes for that check-in time just to see. Other times it may be the whole 15 minutes. It may go 30 minutes. But the thing is, if you don't have that routine of personal touch and conversation, and that they know that this is the place that they can come present problems, then if you don't do that, then that's how those problems build up until they explode. And now you really have a critical disaster that you have to take care of. So having that type of routine. So there's that level of accountability. On the other side, you know, influence is a beautiful thing in that it's results driven. So you know you're not implementing it correctly or something's not clicking if you're not getting the results. And obviously in my world, results are dollars. And it doesn't always have to be. That's just usually what people hire me for, is for them to generate more revenue. Mm-hmm. So in the world of public speaking, I am always hesitant I pay close attention to when somebody says, "Oh, I'm a great speaker. I love being on stage." And I always get, let's say, if they say like standing ovations, or it's not even standing ovations, they'll say, "Oh, people always come up to me afterwards and say that it was great." And the audience applauds. And I think, now it's all, again, what is your objective? Influence is communication with a goal. So what is your goal? If your goal is to feel good on stage, if your goal is to hear applause, if your goal is to feel like you made a connection with at least one person, then great. That was a success. Hands down, more power to you. Love it. In my world, there's a different metric. And that metric is, did you get another booking from that speech? Did somebody hand you a business card saying, "I want to give you money for you to do that again"? And by far, my best marketing piece of me as a professional speaker is me being on stage. I haven't had to do much outbound marketing for my speeches for a number of years now. Now, granted, I am not one of those road warriors that wants to be on stage 300 days out of the year, and I have friends that absolutely love that lifestyle. Good on them. That's great. But for me, if I book a speech a month or two, I'm good. I'm a happy camper. I got other aspects of my business that I enjoy just as much. And so you know that speech has worked if somebody says, I want to give you money to do that again. You know that your sales calls are working and you're using the techniques correctly and being influential if somebody says, yes, I want to hire you. Here's my check. You know that your lead magnet is successful and your landing page is good if a certain number of visitors, certain percentage of visitors are signing up for it. Like, so in a sense, those things should be your accountability markers, so to speak. Those are the metrics in that, yes, this is working. Now, some people fall, this is a discussion that I've had with clients is sometimes they fall in love with their message too much. And another big principle, and I mean big principle of influence, is communication flexibility. Meaning what might persuade you doesn't necessarily mean it's going to persuade somebody else. And what persuaded that person may not persuade another person.
Right.
So you have to be able to develop that flexibility in your communication to be able to say the exact same thing 50 different ways. And so you can't fall in love with your message if it's not working for you. If it's working for you, great. For example, the dark arts aspect of my brand, that's working for me. People literally introduce me as the dark arts chick. and so great, that stays. But there's been tons of other things that I've used in the past that I thought, oh, that's cool, that's sexy. And it didn't land. So, okay, then I got to find the other thing that sticks.
Right. Those all being accountability markers. Yeah, understood.
Yeah.
So I'm going to, a couple more questions and I'm going to sort of close it out, focusing on modern trends and things that are going on in the world today.
Oh God. I don't know if I want to answer these.
That's, I mean, not too incendiary, so don't worry too much. But the first one is interesting to me because a lot of what we've talked about, it does deal with words, but it deals with words in the form of conversation and oral communication.
Yeah.
Modern day communication is going very quickly to digital, and in some cases, yep, digital only. So you're training these people in methods that can or cannot be applied to the digital realm. And I guess that's a question, poorly phrased, but there it is. And then if they can't, then what tools are you giving them to move ahead in the digital world so that they're communicating and influencing effectively?
Yeah. Every single thing can be used in the digital realm. There's not one thing that I teach that can't be applied digitally. In fact, most of my clients apply them digitally. With that said, however, when you see a trend going, and I feel like Tim Ferriss has said this in the past, I'm going to butcher it. But when you see a trend going in one direction, oftentimes there's opportunities in what is being, where that trend is not going. Again, I told you I was going to butcher that. But let me be more specific. If human communication is trending digitally, and there is no denying that we as human beings, our hardwiring is that we want to feel connection. We want to feel seen. We want to feel heard. We want to feel understood. We want to feel validated. If we know that that's wired into us, and if everything, quote unquote, is going digitally, then guess what? Those real conversations, those real interactions are now more valuable. So I have seen so many people who say, I want to sell high ticket items. And they do all of these low ticket techniques in the digital realm because, ooh, that's sexy. Ooh, that's trendy. Ooh, that's easy. If I just point and click and then I can sell a bunch of stuff. And then lo and behold, it's really difficult. And yeah, they might be able to sell a couple hundred bucks for something here, a couple hundred bucks of something there. But you can definitely sell high ticket, awesome services and products when somebody feels a connection to you, when they feel seen, when they feel heard, when they feel understood, when they feel validated. So if anything, I especially want the entrepreneurs that are listening to this to realize that human communication, that human interaction, that element that is not going anywhere, which is our humanity, is now worth so much more than it was in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s, because people are putting way too much focus on digital. And if you can be the person that can have that conversation that spurs their emotions, that charges their heart, that opens their eyes, that energizes their mind, then congratulations, you have the, you know, yellow brick road paved right in front of you.
That's an interesting point, is that our humanity, our human nature, our innate abilities and needs don't change even as communication methods do. So well said there. I'm wondering, sort of the final main question, some of your clients have been politicians, if I'm not mistaken, government officials, and you certainly learned techniques from some of them, as well as operatives in those in the intelligence communities. I'm wondering, and I don't need to dig into specifics or individuals, but what major pitfalls are you seeing in those realms today, specifically in government and politics, and how can we learn from those?
Oh, man.
Dreading this question.
Yeah, I knew it was coming. So, but I like, but you phrased it differently than I expected, so that's good. What are the pitfalls that I'm seeing in that realm? Well, to be honest, I think politicians are still struggling and still trying to catch up with the digital era, meaning the news cycle. I think last I heard, news cycles are like 10 hours. When back in the day, like I know I watched the show The West Wing every once in a while.
Oh, yeah, I love that show.
Yeah, and they talk about the news cycle on that show, and it's like, and that will be in the news cycle all this week. Very few things last an entire week in our world. And so, like, for example, you know, Hawaii just had this false missile alarm that went off, and that's no longer part of the news cycle. And we're only like 4 days after that. So I think politicians all with that are struggling with how to keep up with it, how to control the narrative. And also because our consumption of news is so fast, it's difficult for politicians to make an imprint, make a real, true connection in a positive way. Usually the only time you know the name of a politician is when they've screwed up. And so there's no simple answer to this, but honestly, I think over time, my hope is that we see more authentic politicians that actually speak their mind. Now, I know it's going to take a while, but the reason why I say that is one of the reasons why you don't know politicians is because they try to be so vanilla. They try to be so literally politically correct. They're editing their words. They come across as talking statues. I just listened to an interview recently from a woman who's on the FCC commission talking about, or on the FCC talking about net neutrality. And what she's saying is fantastic, but she just sounds so metered. She sounds so, you know, edited, and it's just, and it kind of was frustrating because I'm like, man, this message could be so much more compelling if you just, it came across that you said what you actually were thinking. And so I think it will take a lot of time for that to happen, but I'd love to see that be the shift in the political spectrum.
Yeah. Well, and it goes back to your point about actual connection. And in this case, connection with constituents. So
yes,
absolutely true. And I think that that sentiment is widespread. Last question before I let you go. How could I have done this interview better?
Oh, you're one of those people.
I'm one of those people. I don't know what that means, but.
You're adorable. I think, well, first of all, let me start by saying with what I was impressed by. For the listeners that don't know, I didn't send you like questions ahead of time. We said this would just be an organic conversation. I've been on podcast interviews where clearly the person didn't do any research whatsoever. Like they didn't even go to my homepage, clearly. Right. At the very least, I can tell you went to my website, which is appreciated, and you understood some of the context of me, my branding. So I was impressed by that and I enjoyed that and I'm thankful and appreciative for that. If it depends on your goals, influence is communication with a goal. So sure. If this isn't on the path of the goal that you're looking for, then that's totally fine. I would say, if anything, I would just, if I were to be listening to you as a listener of a podcast, I would want to feel more of your personality come through, feel more connected to you. Yes, you're a catalyst to shine a light on your guests, but I think there is a possible potential opportunity for you to, I don't know, just share your experiences or share your thoughts and interject that a little bit more. So it's like, oh yeah, it's really enjoy listening to that guy. I don't care who he has on. He's cool kind of a thing. Is that helpful?
No, it is. It absolutely is. And I don't record many of these. Most of them are just phone calls and I take written notes and then compile those notes for interviews.
Gotcha.
But that's helpful across the boards, whether I'm recording it or not. Because you're right, I do approach it as though you're in the spotlight and that's the intent of the interview. And so why would I interject unnecessarily? Because I don't want to derail your thoughts or your opinions or advice or guidance or whatever it is you're sharing. But what you said is well taken. So I'll take that and run with it.
Yeah. And if it's, like I said, it depends on the goal. So if you're taking more of a journalistic approach and just simply want to provide the content and put in the different formats, yeah, totally get it. But if you are wanting to create a podcast that you are the reason why people follow, like a radio right. lab or something like that, then yeah, there might be an opportunity there.
Yeah. Well, duly noted. I'll work on that for future podcast episodes. For folks who aren't familiar with Cherie, you can go visit her website. It's Cherie-Alexander.com. Is that correct?
Yeah. The easy one, just because nobody knows how to spell my name because it's a weird name. the easiest one to remember is ObserveConnectInfluence.com.
Okay. And it has a lot of similar information in your bio about services like consultation opportunities, that kind of thing?
Yep, everything's
there. All's on there. Great. All right. Well, again, thank you, Cherie, so much for your time. And this should be going on Early to Rise Radio here soon. So listen in for that. And we'll talk again soon, hopefully.
Sounds great. I appreciate it, Jeff.
All right. Thanks, Cherie. Take care.
Oh, thank you so much, Cherie and Jeff. What great advice, and so much of it can be used every single day, even right now in your next conversation. I really, truly believe, and Cherie showed, that words are powerful and they can change your life. So I'd love to hear what you think about today's show and how you're going to use Cherie's advice to build your brand, land a sale, and improve your relationships. Keep me posted and please email me at support@earlytorise.com or send me a message on Instagram @RealCraigValentine or Twitter.com/CraigValentine. Thanks for listening to Early to Rise Radio. Please head over to iTunes and rate today's show, share it with your friends, and don't forget, build your belief system, own your life, and never stop learning.